Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an analysis of the political upheaval in Turkey, where massive demonstrations have taken place in response to a brutal government crackdown on environmental protesters. Asla Bali, a professor at the UCLA School of Law, who is in Istanbul, joins us for an update on the protests and what this means in terms of Turkey's role in the opposition to the Assad regime in Syria. Then we will get another analysis on protests against the Islamist government of Prime Minister Erdogan from Sona Chapte, who is a regular columnist for Hurriyet Daily News, who writes extensively on U.S.-Turkish relations and Turkish domestic policy. He joins us to discuss what looks like a widening religious secular divide in a country long dominated by the military that has recently seen unprecedented growth and prosperity and an emerging middle class. Then finally, we will speak with Michael Clare, a five-college professor of peace and world security studies, about the arms pouring into Syria from Russia and whether there will be a renewed Cold War-like arms race in the region with Russia arming Assad and the U.S. arming Israel. Michael Clare has an article at the Huffington Post, The Cold War Redux. And joining us now from Istanbul, Turkey, is Asla Bali, who's a professor at the UCLA School of Law, where she teaches courses on public international law, international human rights, and the laws of war. And she has a forthcoming book called The Legality Legitimacy Debate in the Context of Nonproliferation. Welcome to Background Briefing, Asla Bali.
Hi.
Tell us about this spontaneous demonstration that took place in response to a police crackdown on environmental protesters who are protesting trees being cut down in a park to accommodate a new shopping mall. My understanding is that this was a massive demonstration that was completely spontaneous, and people showed up in the thousands at 3 a.m. Is that right?
Well, this has been now going on for quite a number of days. We're actually in the sixth day today of the protests. On the first day, the numbers of protesters were probably under 100, so 50 to 75 people who were there, as you say, environmentalists who were there protesting the bulldozing of trees in a historic park in Taksim Square, which is the most important central square in Istanbul. It's sort of the Tahrir Square, if you want, of Istanbul, which is the largest city in Turkey, although not the capital, but the capital has also seen major protests, which is Ankara. Those protesters were met with a violent crackdown by the police, and some of the images, which were distributed very rapidly over social media, of the kind of brutality that those protesters met with led to, as you say, spontaneous acts of solidarity, people flooding to the square. And so by the third and fourth days of the protest, you had, as you say, thousands, and indeed on Friday and into Saturday, tens of thousands. Some organizers have said that the number was over 100,000, possibly as many as 200,000 protesters in the square yesterday. Yesterday, which was Saturday here, up to about 4 p.m, there were very serious, violent police repression in the square involving the excessive use of tear gas, pepper spray, water cannon, and barricades all over to try to prevent people from being able to access the square. Many parts of traffic all around the city were closed off. There was a major opposition rally that had been planned, a party meeting, for 4 p.m. on Saturday. The opposition party, which is called the Cumhuriyet Halk Partisi, the Republican People's Party, had scheduled this meeting far in advance, not related in any way to the protest, but the coincidence of that planned rally with the events that were taking place in Taksim Square meant that it took on increased significance. The party leader, the head of the opposition, traveled to Istanbul for that meeting, and it was widely anticipated the meeting would be extremely large. The meeting was on the Asian side of the city, in a part of the city called Kadıköy. The party opposition leader, particularly in response to a set of provocative statements from the prime minister, decided to cancel that meeting and call upon all of his party members who had planned to attend the meeting to continue to Taksim Square, to go to relocate themselves to the square where the protests were taking place, at which point the government was faced with a choice. Are they going to continue the incredible crackdown that had seen really gales of tear gas and pepper spray overtake large parts of the European side of the city, areas where tourists are located, major luxury hotels and so forth? Were they going to redouble the violence, or were they going to step back? And the decision was taken to pull the police back from the center of the square. There were still numbers of clashes for hours thereafter, and also clashes at the major port that connects the Asian side to the European side, Beşiktaş, where you had hundreds and thousands of protesters arriving in order to join. The protesters already in Taksim Square, you had incidents there continuing late into the night last night. But nonetheless, the police withdrew from the square around 4 p.m. Yesterday. And since then, the mood has turned in turns violent at some point. There were much more militant protesters who came out and engaged in clashes with the police that were now in different positions outside of the square. And that led to a series of acts of violence, which some of which has been portrayed by the government to suggest that the entire movement is somehow a set of violent looters, which is completely false. These were marginal incidents at the, you know, very isolated, but there were, you know, cars burned, buses and trucks overturned, shop windows broken, stones thrown, and so forth at different times last night. Today has been much calmer. Again, the police presence has not as yet returned to Taksim, although there's a chance that that might happen later tonight. It's now 9 p.m. in Istanbul. It could happen later. It could happen overnight. Part of what really drove the anger of the protesters was a 5 a.m. raid that occurred Thursday night, Friday morning. For those protesters who had camped out in the square, they met with severe violence from the police at 5 a.m. when everybody was asleep, and that really fueled the fire on Friday and Saturday. And it's not beyond the possibility, beyond the pale for this government to engage in something similar tonight. So it's not known yet, but there are thousands of people that have streamed to Taksim over the course of today. And it's at this point peaceful, celebratory. People are very happy with what they feel has been a victory against the incredible police brutality that they faced earlier on in the protests. And they want to show strength in numbers to prevent the police from coming to reoccupy the square. Of course, in the meantime, the source of the protests and the things that people are protesting have grown well beyond the original question of bulldozing of trees. But really, even the bulldozing of trees question was not simply an environmentalist question. The sense is that this government is essentially committed to a neoliberal, business-oriented set of policies that raise multiple historic sites and important districts in Turkey to make way for shopping malls and other major business projects, many of which are ill-conceived, exhibit very poor urban planning, and so forth. And so Istanbul in particular, where there had already been numbers of protests over the past course of last year for other instances in which the government had chosen to demolish historically significant or places that are important from the perspective of the public and the public arena to make way for shopping malls, this was just deemed the last straw. So that's what set off these protests. And now it's a much wider coalition of people that are really simply angry with the way in which the government is conducting itself and adopting policies in a kind of what is perceived as an authoritarian manner, and adopting policies without sufficient public consultation, and policies that really run against the grain of what many different urban dwellers, in particular in Turkey, think would be the appropriate direction that should be taken. So between things like restrictions on alcohol sales, public remonstration of individuals for example, kissing in public, which was deemed to be some kind of a morality question, public morality question, to the demolition of various historic sites. There's just an accumulation of resentment and anger over various initiatives undertaken by this government. And in the background of all of this are a number of much broader issues: Kurdish reconciliation, the government's foreign policy towards Syria, its overall economic policies and wealth inequality in Turkey, its treatment of urban spaces, and the possibility that this particular prime minister is pursuing a constitutional reform project to put in place in Turkey a more presidential system with an eye himself to becoming president, which many think of as the final power grab. And they simply do not want to see the current prime minister install himself as some kind of Chavez-style figure in Turkey.
And again, I'm speaking with Asla Bali, who is in Istanbul, Turkey. She is a professor at the UCLA School of Law. And the response from Prime Minister Erdogan has been arrogant and dismissive. He said, they are putting on airs saying we massacre trees. I ask in the name of God, Erdogan is a dictator. If you are the kind of person who can call someone who serves their people a dictator, then I have no words for you. So how much is this prime minister driven by his own religious righteousness?
I think that it would be a mistake to understand what's happening right now as a secularist-Islamist divide. I understand that that might be the framing that some have pursued. I think that's an oversimplification and also basically misunderstands much of what's happening in the square. What's interesting about the people who've come out, not only are they of all ages and largely a middle-class crowd, of course, with university students and other kinds of organized union and so forth also supporting, but you have a huge outpouring of the general public. You also have women in headscarves. You have people who are religiously conservative who are simply fed up with the tone, as you say, the arrogance and dismissiveness of the government. So this is really not about religious secular divide. This is about a broader set of underlying policy questions that cut across that divide. It is very much a referendum on this prime minister. He's an extremely popular politician in Turkey. He's deemed a very charismatic leader by many. He certainly has gone from victory to victory in the elections in which the party has run as a whole, including the most recent elections in 2011 when they won a near outright majority, which he invokes all the time, saying, you know, I was able to come to power through the ballot box. These demonstrators don't have any right to express themselves other than by the ballot box. The difficulty is that the opposition in Turkey is splintered and the vote gets fragmented among different opposition strains. And it is true that the political party that the prime minister comes from is very likely to be successful in the next round of elections as well. But this is more of a personal referendum on him and the style of his leadership and the way in which he personally has been governing in a quite authoritarian manner. So it's not that he's come to power as a dictator. It's true that he's come to power through the electoral box, but his personal style is extremely off-putting, and particularly his repeated invocation of his electoral victory, which, while a very serious and strong showing of support, was not even 50%. We have a multi-party system, so when you have many parties competing, getting anywhere near 50% is a major electoral victory, but it still doesn't represent even a complete majority, a simple majority of the country, let alone the many others who he's alienating. And also he's alienated many of his own base with the tone he's taken, with the high-handedness of the policy announcement, with no consultation from one day to the next. You have no idea what new initiative the government is going to announce. We're going to raise this public square. We're going to destroy this historic monument. We're going to make way for this shopping mall or this major futurist project. I mean, they've named dozens of such projects in the last year. Only 5 days ago, he was inaugurating the opening of the third bridge to cross the Bosphorus, which is going to have very serious environmental consequences and urban consequences for the city. And they've chosen to name that bridge, furthermore, for a historic Ottoman figure, a sultan who is best known, or well known at least, for the fact that he had massacred thousands of Aydınlı people who are from a religious minority in Turkey, a heterodox Muslim group who themselves feel very embattled at the moment. And so this announcement, the announcement of a major new airport that's going to be built in Istanbul, I mean, he's involved in a set of infrastructure projects that he plans to stamp with his name, essentially, as this is the accomplishment of this party. And no one stands in the way, or nobody opposes the need to for urban planning, for new projects, for infrastructure to support the size of the population. But the high-handed methods, the heavy-handedness of the response to opposition, all of this has produced a very serious front that is calling for the resignation of the prime minister. The likelihood of accomplishing that, I think, is very low, but he himself, the prime minister, albeit in a very arrogant manner, has been forced to acknowledge first the unpopularity of this project to destroy the Taksim Gezi Park, the excursion park in Taksim. A court, in any case, has issued what amounts to a temporary restraining order, preventing them from going forward with the project. He's appealing that, but he's had to acknowledge that there's opposition. He's also had to acknowledge that mistakes have been made in the decisions by the Minister of the Interior and the head of security, who have authorized this incredible police crackdown and the pulling back of the police as a result, and the symbolism of the court victory are all being celebrated today by the protesters as victory in their battle to create a more accountable government and greater accountability around these policy initiatives.
Well, just in closing, Ashraf Ali, I'm sure that this may well be the beginning of galvanizing an opposition that you say is split, but I'm curious to know what miscalculations Erdogan made in foreign policy, because it seems like he and Hillary Clinton and others thought that the Assad regime would fall. And of course, Erdogan himself was very close to Assad in Syria. I believe the families got together for vacations and holidays, etc. And I'm also curious to know why, after the bombing that killed so many people inside of Turkey, which clearly came from Syria, why there was such a muted response or no response whatsoever from Turkey and something of a press blackout.
Yes, and indeed the media actually, I mean, I will turn to a foreign policy question, but one big sub-story of this overall set of protests is the absolute gag order and muzzle that this government has placed on the media and the crackdown on independent journalism. As you probably know, Turkey now has a dubious distinction of having imprisoned the largest proportion of journalists of any country in the world, with both China and Iran behind Turkey in this respect. And this has been a hallmark of this government. You would not have been able to know that these protests were taking place, let alone the scale of the protests, by watching any number of Turkish news stations, which were showing documentaries about penguins and dolphins and far-flung human interest stories from Mongolia, instead of covering what was actually happening in the country yesterday in particular. In fact, there's a movement and there's a hashtag that's trending on Twitter to boycott CNN Turk, the CNN affiliate in Turkey, because it had failed to give the coverage that even CNN International was prepared to give. And this is a consequence of the muzzle that the government has placed on the media, which also applies, as you say, to the deaths of the 52 Turkish citizens in Reyhan as a result of bombings associated with the Syria policy. One difficulty about that bombing is it's actually difficult to know who specifically to attribute the bombing to. It's not clear that it was, in fact, pro-government forces. It may as much have been opposition forces or Islamist forces or others related to Turkey's Syria policy seeking to galvanize a stronger response from Turkey. And I think part of the reason why you haven't seen that stronger response is confusion as to the motivation for the bombing and whether or not further engagement of Turkey and Syria is prudent at this time or might give way to even greater bombing. There have been some scattered reports, for example, of the discovery of sarin gas canisters in Turkey that may or may not have been brought in by opposition forces that were able to overtake, warehouse facilities, perhaps in parts of Syria, or maybe it's pro-government forces that have brought them in. It's very hard to know, but there's a very large refugee population, Syrian refugee population, that takes various different political positions on the conflict, and Turkey is uncertain how to proceed in responding to acts of violence that may or may not be emanating from different groups in Syria and having effects here in Turkey. That said, there are two sets of miscalculations that this government has made. One has to do with the actual course of events in Syria, and I'm happy to talk about that, but before I turn to that, I think it's what's connected to these protests is the miscalculation of this government as to the appetite of the Turkish public for the foreign policy course that the government has taken. There is very little support and tremendous opposition to the government's degree of involvement in Syria at this stage. Many in Turkey, including people from the base of the government, the people who have voted for the AKP in the past, question why the Turkish government has decided to allow armed opposition groups to be headquartered in Turkey, why we've taken such a strong stance with respect to a civil war in a neighboring country, and what ultimately the Turkish national interest is in this hardline position. Also, there are those who argue that the Turkish government has taken an increasingly sectarian stance and that they themselves don't identify, the Turkish public largely does not identify with the sectarianism being evinced by the government's foreign policy. So there's a lot of criticism and a lot of opposition to the exposure that the Erdogan government has created for Turkey on the Syrian question. He does not have widespread public support on the Syria foreign policy. So that's a domestic miscalculation, quite apart from the possible ramifications of the government's position and belief that Assad would fall for the success of their foreign policy in Syria itself.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today from Istanbul, Turkey. Asla Bale.
I'm delighted to have been with you.
Again, I've been speaking with Asla Bale, who's a professor at the UCLA School of Law, where she teaches courses on public international law, international human rights, and the laws of war. She has a forthcoming book called The Legality Legitimacy Debate in the Context of Non-Proliferation. We're going to take a brief station break and be back getting another opinion on what is happening in Turkey. Yalan, başkası yalan, dünyada ölümden başkası yalan, yalan, başkası yalan. Joining us now is Sona Çapte, who's director of the Turkish Research Program at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. He has written extensively on U.S.-Turkish relations and Turkish domestic politics and is a regular columnist for Hürriyet Daily News and serves as the chair of the Turkey Advanced Area Studies Program at the State Department's Foreign Service Institute. Welcome to Background Briefing, Sona Çapte.
Glad to be with you.
And the demonstrations that are taking place in Istanbul are pretty extensive. You had 1,000 people arrested. It seems to have started out as an environmental protest, but it's sort of morphed into a kind of secular religious divide. Am I correct?
I think it's beyond that. I think this is not the typical secular versus religious Turkey. I think this is a debate over the nature and the quality of democracy in Turkey. In the last decade, the governing party in Turkey, AKP, has created a vast middle class in Turkey by implementing sound economic policies. As a result of that, for the first time in its history, Turkey has become a middle class society. Now this middle class that the governing party has created is telling this very party that has created it, well, you know, you don't have to be all my way when it comes to politics. Listen to us, listen to our views. And I think the debate over the park is emblematic of this attitude of this new middle class, which cherishes individual rights and is increasingly taking issue with the style of governance. So I think the debate in Turkey is really about style of governance and really about the path towards a liberal understanding of democracy.
But when you speak of a style of governance, when Prime Minister Erdogan talks about and has proceeded to restrict alcohol and has suggested that people who drink are automatically alcoholics. Is there not a moralistic subtext here?
Indeed, there is. I think Erdogan's success has been that he has pushed aggressively free market economics, at the same time promoting an image of a family guy leader. And that worked to an extent, I think, in the sense that he delivered a lot of prosperity, and that has delivered him popularity that almost reached 50% as of the most recent elections. But at the same time, I think many Turks, even those who do not drink, do not feel comfortable with the government legislating on the issue. And this, as I said earlier, I think suggests the rise of an individualistic middle-class society where people are saying, these are our liberties, the government should not get in our way. And as a result of that, I think this is a really an interesting turn in Turkish politics. I would say Turkey is turning about to pass a threshold where it is now becoming a society in which a government, regardless of how successful it is economically, can no more dictate its vision of what a society should look like on the rest of the society without building consensus. So far, I think in the last 10 years, the Erdogan's strongman image, an image that basically meant that he could push forward policies without much regard for building consensus or creating debate, and now come to a stop. The public wants debate and wants their opinion to be taken into account. They're basically saying they might support his economic policies and they might vote for him, but he should still listen to them when implementing major policies, including policies such as building a shopping mall in downtown Istanbul. Ironically, it is a very middle class that the government has created is saying no to yet one more shopping mall. They're saying, we want our park, and this is what sparked the entire protest, as you know.
So, Sona Çapte, this government, though, has shown some sort of repressive tendencies. I mean, it's arrested an awful lot of military people, I think of some journalists as well, that is based on this preemptive idea that the military is still restive and have to be kept in their barracks. So where do civil-military relations stand at the moment?
I think in terms of that, Turkey has really come to a different universe. There was a time when the military was the kingmaker in Turkey and the political authorities simply listened to the military. That is no more the case. The government has fully subjugated the military to its power. And I think a lot of the people thought that this was the path for a liberal Turkey to emerge when they saw the civil-military relationship recalibrated. But what has come forth, although the military has disappeared from politics, is a government that has won three successive elections, has increased its political power over the spectrum, and has increasingly started to say that its vision of what Turkey should look like should be shared by all Turks. And now you're seeing a lot of Turks, including those who support the governing party, saying, you know what, it just is not right for a government to tell its citizens how to live, regardless of how successful its policies are. I think at this stage, the path forward for the AKP is to realize that it may be the most popular party in the country, but that does not mean that all its policies are popular.
Again, I'm speaking with Sona Çapte, who's the director of the Turkish Research Program at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. He's written extensively on U.S.-Turkish relations and Turkish domestic politics, and is a regular columnist for Hürriyet Daily News, and serves as the chair of the Turkish Advanced Area Studies Program at the State Department's Foreign Service Initiative. Now, obviously, this government of Erdogan, the AKP party, I believe that Erdogan had very close personal relations with the Syrian dictator Assad. But then, with Assad's brutal treatment of protesters that has led to this seemingly endless and incredibly brutal civil war that's going on, it does seem that the Turkish government, and indeed Secretary of State Hillary Clinton and others, underestimated Assad's staying power. They initially seemed to think that he would fall pretty quickly in the way that the Arab Spring has played out. But the Russians are doubling down, the Iranians are, and Hezbollah are, and it looks like at this point he's holding on. What is going on then in terms of Erdogan's relationship with Syria, and the lack of response to the bombing that took place in Turkey recently, where there's been a news blackout and absolutely nothing coming from the government? So what's going on?
Well, Turkey went all the way out to confront the Assad regime's crackdown once the Damascus government basically refused to listen to Ankara's advice that it should not be using violence and it should be reforming in response to the demonstrators' demands. When that did not come forth, Turkey's policy flipped. Turkey went from being one of the closest friends of the Assad government to becoming its staunchest regional opponent, to the extent that it started to host the Syrian opposition and became a safe haven for the fighters in northern Syria. It's not an accident that most of the areas liberated by the opposition are in northern Syria, in areas next to Turkey, suggesting that Turkey's support to the rebels has made a difference. But at the same time, Turkey does not have game-changing proxies or allies in Syria whose power would suffice to topple the Assad regime. As a result of that, Turkey's Syria policy has come to a standstill, because the Assad regime is, as you say, backed by the Russians and supported and armed by the Iranians and now by Lebanese Hezbollah. Turkey does not have that kind of hard power. It can neither match the Russians' complex maneuvering in international environments, such as at the UN, nor Iran's hard power force, such as the Hezbollah and actual militia and arms that flow to the regime. So it's finding out the shortcomings of its policy, where it wanted to push the Assad government out, and he thought that, you know, a Western alliance would build up, as well as some Arab countries, to force that regime out. But all that has not sufficed, and I think Ankara is finding out that it's too exposed, perhaps, to the Syrian conflict, as shown by the recent unfortunate terror attacks inside Turkey. So in a way, Turkey's Syria policy is showing to Turkey the very limits of Turkey's ambitions to be a Middle East player, and saying that, you know, perhaps some countries are involved in the idea of getting to become Middle East players, but it's never that easy, and even countries such as the United States had their hands burnt, and this time Turkey's realizing that maybe the Middle East is too hot for it to grasp.
So I take it, though, that intervention, even though it's unlikely, and as you have just explained, the Turkish people, I don't believe, are in support of any kind of intervention on the part of the Turkish military. But what state is the Turkish military in, given that this government has asserted control over it?
Well, this is NATO's second largest military, so it is a powerful force. But at the same time, it's a big force, but it still needs U.S. technology, hardware, things as simple as Patriot missiles, which are used for point defense. Syria has missiles. Turkey does not have technology to protect itself against those missiles, so it asked the U.S. and other NATO allies to deploy Patriot missiles in Turkey. So Turkey's military is powerful and mighty. It is the second largest. It is one of the most advanced in the region, but it nevertheless does not have the hardware to match the weapons capacity of the Assad regime and his allies, Iran and Russia. So I think that has pushed Turkey's military, but also the government, to pivot further to the U.S. in search of security assistance, security guarantees that Turkey will not be exposed to the fallout of the Syria war should the Assad regime decide to provoke Ankara into a conflict or target Turkey. And I think as a result of that, you've seen closer ties between Turkey and U.S. than has been the case for at least a decade. The Syrian war has pushed the two countries closer together.
And what about its relations with Israel, which used to be close and have obviously got incredibly frayed by the Israeli commando attack on the Turkish ship that killed a number of Turks?
We have seen an uptick in Turkish-Israeli ties, and that too is related to the war in Syria, just as the significant improvement in Turkish-American ties is mostly related to Syria, in the sense that Syria projects a similar kind of threat to both Turks and Israelis, the idea of a failed state, a Somalia-style failed state that would be an incubator for radical groups that borders both Turkey and Syria. That this is a regime that has chemical weapons that could proliferate and fall into wrong hands is a threat to both Turkey and Syria. So the two countries are finding out that they may have had disagreements in the past, but it is time for them to get over that and talk to each other once again. At the same time, I think U.S. President Obama's intervention to bring the Turkish and Israeli leaders together so they would work together again and start talking was useful in bringing forward Turkish-Israeli rapprochement. It's not to say that Turkish-Israeli ties are going to go back to what they were in the 1990s, when they were very intimate security, military ties and cooperation, but it is to say that this is going to be a new relationship that will have some significant elements that will include cooperation on Syria, that will include a significant amount of trade. Ironically, or perhaps not so ironically, because Turkey and Israel are the two most developed economies in the region, despite the downturn in political ties, Turkish-Israeli economic ties are booming, and they actually were increasing at a higher pace. Trade was increasing at a higher pace after the 2010 flotilla incident than it was before. So one could see where trade remains and becomes an even more important component of the relationship. Syria is an important area of cooperation, though the two countries will continue to have areas of disagreement, such as Turkey and Israel will diverge on how to deal with Hamas and as well as perhaps some other regional issues. But I think overall, this is not a no relationship, but it is rather a new relationship in the wake of the Arab Spring between Turks and Israelis.
So, Sona Kapche, tell me, though, about you're suggesting that Erdogan's got some blowback in effect for bringing up and nurturing a Turkish middle class, and now they're sort of turning on him. But what explains the very brutal reaction of the police, the heavy-handed nature of what he seems to be doing, and give us a sense in terms of his religiosity in the American context? You know, we have the Republican Party in this country is clearly influenced by the religious right, but I think it's still a fairly secular country. But in terms of religion and politics, it's pretty clear that people that are religious think in very absolute terms. They're not necessarily very tolerant, and they certainly aren't given to any nuance. So is there an inherent problem? Is there an inherent divide here between the secular, the young Turks in particular, who seem to want to live a kind of a Western-style life, this man who's talking about family values
I don't think this is a secular versus religious divide. I think this is a divide about style of governance. What has worked in Turkey for the last decade and before that was the idea that a strongman, sort of like Latin America, would be elected democratically and then could kind of do whatever he or she wanted because they were elected, and elected people can get to do what they want. That is no more the case in Turkey. I think what you're seeing in Turkey, not about religion, not about secularism, it is about the fact that a lot more people are now saying democracy is not just winning elections, it is also building consensus. And the fact that the government dismissed this, what looked like a mini protest over a park in downtown Istanbul and used violence to crack down on it, brought tens of thousands of people in the middle of the night to Istanbul's downtown at 3 a.m. in the morning. People said, you know what, that's not how democracy is supposed to work out. And people are basically saying that this is supposed to be a style of governance where democratically elected governments, however popular they are, cannot dismiss public opinion when it comes to major social or political projects. And I think this is going to be Turkey's new turn from now on.
But this is not to say then that Erdogan's is he not motivated by a kind of absolutism that comes along with people who are religious?
I don't see the relationship. I think Erdogan is a leader who thinks that he has majority vote, and majority vote means that he can basically implement his political projects on the rest of the society. And I think democracy is not majoritarianism. It is not rule of majority, rule by majority. It is also protection of the rights of the minorities and different groups, and also the idea of egalitarian values. And I think we're basically seeing what we could be seeing in most other democratic systems, where someone who comes to power with overwhelming support and stays in power through consecutive terms decides to think that they can dismiss public opinion. And I think in Turkey, this is increasingly not proving to be the case.
And this, just in closing, this could lead, do you think, to a revival of the opposition?
It all depends. There are people in the opposition who want to cast this ideologically. As I said earlier, if this is cast to be made a secular versus religious divide, it will not work. I think we are going to see, whether or not the demonstrations stay around or fizzle out, we are going to see a new awareness in Turkey on issues such as the environment, such as urban heritage, such as individual liberties. And I think this is going to be the new push against the governing party, which has pretty much had a free ride in the last 10 years because it had delivered phenomenal economic growth by making Turkey one of the G20 countries and tripling Turkey's income per capita and making Turkey as economy larger than most European economies. It thought that it could kind of move forward with any policies, social or political, without the need to build consensus and promote debate because it delivered growth and because it made the Turks wealthy. I think, ironically, a lot of the Turks are saying, yes, you made us wealthy, but now listen to us and make sure that getting elected and being popular does not mean that you get to do everything you want, but also listen to our views. So I think, to me, this is the Turkish democracy passing a test. It is saying that it is, in fact, the modernization theory working. The modernization theory says that when societies become majority middle class, they do become democratic in a rather entrenched fashion. And maybe this is exactly what's happening in Turkey.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Sona Çapçay.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Sona Çapçay, who is the director of the Turkish Research Program at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. He has written extensively on U.S.-Turkish relations and Turkish domestic politics and is a regular columnist for Hürriyet Daily News and serves as chair of the Turkey Advanced Area Studies Program at the State Department's Foreign Service Initiative. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back talking about a new Cold War between the United States and a combination of China and Russia. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Michael Clare, who's a Five College Professor of Peace and World Security Studies and Director of the Five College Program in Peace and World Security Studies at Hampshire College. His books include American Arms Supermarket, World Security, Challenges for a New Century, Rogue States and Nuclear Outlaws, Blood and Oil, and most recently, The Race for What's Left, The Global Scramble for the World's Last Resources. He has an article at the Huffington Post and Tom Dispatch, The Cold War Redux. Welcome to Background Briefing, Michael Clare.
Pleasure to be back with you.
And we're getting some pretty depressing news out of Syria now with the Russians doubling down on arms sales, and they've just announced that they're going to be selling advanced MiG fighters along with these S-300 anti-aircraft missiles that they've threatened to deliver. And also, of course, in the United Nations Security Council on Saturday, Russia blocked a declaration by the Security Council, which would have otherwise passed, expressing grave concerns about the situation in the town of Al-Qusair that's being fought over by Hezbollah and the rebels at the moment, where up to 50,000 civilians are trapped and may well be massacred. So it's pretty cynical on the part of the Russians, but you're suggesting that if this continues on the way it's heading, there's going to be a new kind of Cold War-like arms race emerging?
Yes, I think something like this has been emerging over the past few months, in the past year or so, sort of not visible exactly, but developing nonetheless. I think it's evident in the arms sales that are underway and in the reaction of China, especially in Russia, to the Pacific pivot that President Obama announced. I think the Pacific pivot is a trigger for a lot of this. This is the policy of the U.S. shifting its priority to the Pacific Ocean and putting China on the defensive. This has pushed China closer to Russia, and I think the two of them now see themselves in a kind of Cold War-like struggle with the United States for power and influence in greater Eurasia. So one thing leads to another. It's hard to pin down who's started it all. Like the first Cold War, you can't pin it down. But one thing leads to another, and now Syria is the center of all this.
Well, we know that the president and the new Chinese premier are meeting next weekend in California for a get-together that involves their wives and lots of golf, I imagine. Obviously, with China's growing economy, whether China becomes more militaristic or not, the percentage of their defense budget will automatically go up shortly as the GDP of China rises, which it has been doing at a rather spectacular rate.
Absolutely, and they have announced further increases in their defense spending in recent months. A lot of this focused on the Navy, and not surprisingly, the Navy, because this is where the main axis of confrontation with the United States is taking place, in the East China Sea and the South China Sea. And there have been recent comments from China that they see the United States on a course of containment and the United States acting in a more belligerent manner in the Pacific, and they're going to respond in kind. This will lead to a naval buildup, and I fear a naval arms race. And we just heard in the past few months that China is on its way to buying new submarines from Russia and buying advanced aircraft from Russia. This was when President Xi Jinping made his first trip abroad to Moscow in March or April, where he met with Vladimir Putin, and they apparently agreed to billions of dollars in new Russian arms transfers to China. So you see how all of this is linked together.
Well, again, I'm speaking with Michael Clare, the Five College Professor of Peace and World Security Studies and Director of the Five College Program in Peace and World Security Studies at Hampshire College. His books include American Arms Supermarket, World Security, Challenges for a New Century, Rogue States and Nuclear Outlaws, Blood and Oil, and most recently, The Race for What's Left, The Global Scramble for the World's Last Resources. He has an article at the Huffington Post and Tom Dispatch, The Cold War Redux. And in terms of Russia's arms sales, to the Assad dictatorship, which and Iran, of course, is joining in, and Hezbollah actually have fighters on the ground fighting in this key battle. There is no question that there's a resolve on the part of the Russians, whether it's for geopolitical reasons or just pure cynicism. They are serious, and but the West doesn't seem to be quite sure about what to do. The U.S. has been ambivalent from day one about arming the rebels, and the Saudis and the Qataris are pouring arms into the worst elements in the Syrian opposition, the fundamentalist Salafists. So how do you see this Cold War developing out of the situation in Syria, given that Russia's determined to pour as many arms in as they can to ensure Assad's victory, but the United States doesn't appear to be sure about what to do?
You're right about this, and that's the nature of this new Cold War situation, where the United States is not the superpower it was 10 years ago at the end of the Cold War, when everybody talked about the U.S. as the sole superpower and there were no challengers. It seemed the U.S. could do anything it wanted. But then came the war in Iraq, the war in Afghanistan, the bankruptcy, virtual bankruptcy of the U.S. Treasury fighting those wars. Now the U.S. is stretched thin. And President Obama has said, we have to make the Pacific our focus. And in some sense, this has exposed a weakness. Now, I'm saying this is the way I think it is seen in Moscow and in Tehran, that by shifting to the Pacific, it has made the U.S. appear weaker, less capable than it once was in the Middle East, in Syria. And I think they're saying, aha, we're going to take advantage of the weakening of America's position in the Middle East with the drawdown of U.S. forces in Iraq and Afghanistan and so on. There's an opportunity here to strike back, to gain geopolitical advantage. And I think that's what Vladimir Putin is doing. You use the word cynical. I think this is cold, hard geopolitics of a classical kind, taking advantage of a opening that they see. Now, that doesn't mean that the U.S. is doing nothing. The U.S. is promising tens of billions of dollars in sophisticated weapons to Israel and Saudi Arabia to balance some of the sales that Russia is making.
So the Cold War race, then, arms race would be between Russia's client Syria and America's client Israel?
And Saudi Arabia and Kuwait and the United Arab Emirates, yes. So it's akin to the Cold War, very much like the era when the Soviet Union armed Iraq and Syria, and for a time Egypt, back in the day of Nasser, and the U.S. armed, of course, Israel back then, Iran under the Shah. Remember, this is the way the Cold War was played out, is the U.S. and the Soviet Union providing arms to whatever client state was on the market to get these arms, and they traded back and forth for a while. That's the way the Cold War played itself out, and it's playing itself out the same way again today.
So is this then, Michael Clare, a reaction, this new Cold War, is it a reaction to the neoconservatives and the hubris of the Cheney-Bush years, where the U.S. was the unchallenged superpower, and Paul Wolfowitz argued that now that we're the last man standing, we've got to strut our stuff and make the world in our own image. And as you know, and we all know to our chagrin, that Bush's and Cheney's misadventures in Iraq have done nothing but benefit Iran, and they've completely destroyed U.S.'s diplomatic relationships around the world, inflamed 1.2 billion Muslims But they've also turned out to be a paper tiger, and they bankrupted the United States, and they've been completely counterproductive. So did Bush, his arrogance and his ignorance, is it coming home to roost now that they've...
There are two things going on here, Ian. There's one thing is what you're describing, is that the Bush-Cheney-Rumsfeld drive to be the superpower to end all, the new Rome, is the way they thought of it. We're going to put America's stamp on the Middle East and the world for all time. That's hubris. Yes, now we're seeing the chickens come home to roost. But there's something else in play, and that is that the Obama administration, looking at this, drawing the same conclusion, is saying that for the U.S. to remain a superpower in the 21st century, it has to remain ahead of the greatest threat of all, which is China. And we're going to move our marbles from the Middle East, which is the secondary theater, to the Pacific, which is the primary theater. And we're going to remain the dominant power no matter what in the Pacific. That is the Obama strategy. But that has the unintended or intended consequence of pushing China into Russia's arms. And so it feeds Putin's geopolitical game. Whether that was intended or not, I don't know. But that is the consequence of the Obama reaction to what you're describing, the setback in the Middle East.
But surely, Michael Clare, you're not suggesting that the U.S. should have not just said they were pivoting to Asia and the Pacific, that they were also going to maintain their losing position in the Middle East. I mean, reality has intruded thanks to Bush and his wasting and misuse of American power.
No, I'm not suggesting that at all. I'm suggesting something different. I'm suggesting that the worst thing we can do is to put ourselves on a collision course with China, which is what I think the Obama administration is setting us up for. That's the worst thing that we can do, because it will accelerate this trend towards a new Cold War. That's what I'm trying to say.
Well, in terms of that, in the upcoming discussions next weekend in Palm Springs between the new Chinese leader and President Obama, obviously there's an expectation that they're going to be talking about cyber warfare. So, I mean, it seems pretty clear that the Chinese have been quite aggressive in stealing U.S. military and corporate secrets. What kind of diplomacy could be used here to put this relationship on a less militaristic path?
That's a good question. I think that from the Chinese perspective, I think to them what they are most concerned about is the struggle over the islands in the South China Sea and the East China Sea, what they call the Diaoyu Islands. Japan calls them the Senkaku Islands. And in the South China, that's in the East China Sea. In the South China Sea, the Spratly and Paracel Islands. And the U.S. has been helping China's rivals, Japan in particular, by supporting them with military assistance. And I think this is what China finds most threatening. And I think if the United States said, we're going to pull back from that. We're not going to support Japan and the Philippines and their drive to control those islands. We're going to be neutral on this, totally neutral. Let them work it out. Or at least give the Chinese the impression that we're not backing Japan. I think that would be the kind of quid pro quo that we could negotiate. I think that that's more important to them than the hacking is.
But on the other front, the Middle East, it seems that the Cold War lines are essentially being drawn in the sense that there is a proxy war going on between the Sunni and the Shiites, between the Saudis and the Iranians. And it would seem to me that the Russians have decided to back the Shiites, and the U.S. is stuck with the Sunni because of their toxic relationship to Saudi Arabia.
Now, on that front, I don't want to make prescriptions that I can't back up and say we should do this or that. I think the best thing is we should try to stay out of this as much as possible. What I do think is that that Putin, Russia by itself, is never going to be a major threat. It simply lacks the capacity to be a major threat to the United States or to world security. A combination of Russia and China is a very potent threat. So it's in our best interest and the best interest of everybody to have a world in which Russia and China are not pushed together into a hard alliance against the United States. Remember, they were once in the early days of the Cold War, at the time of the Korean War. That's the worst possible outcome. That would be a formidable foe in a very dangerous situation. And so that's what we have to prevent.
Well, that's a far cry from the time during the latter part of the Cold War when Brezhnev secretly approached the Nixon administration to preemptively bomb the Chinese nuclear sites at Lop Nor in the Gobi Desert.
Yes, and for a period when Nixon went to China and China became a quasi-ally of the United States.
Right.
What I'm saying is that for the past 2 years, what Obama is doing is pushing China increasingly in a hostile, antagonistic direction. And that's bad for the United States.
Well, Michael Clare, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Always my pleasure to have this conversation with you, Ian, anytime.
Well, I'll take you up on that. And I've been speaking with Michael Clare, the Five College Professor of Peace and World Security Studies and Director of the Five College Program in Peace and World Security Studies at Hampshire College. His books include American Arms Supermarket, World Security Challenges for a New Century, Rogue States and Nuclear Outlaws, Blood and Oil, and most recently, The Race for What's Left, The Global Scramble for the World's Last Resources. He has an article at the Huffington Post and Tom Dispatch, The Cold War Redux. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. I'm